As Megan introduced our organization, we are called Rethink Media. And just some background for folks who aren't familiar with Rethink and the work that we do. We describe ourselves as part PR firm, part advocacy organizations, and we, in the Security and Rights Collaborative, basically work on 5 issue areas. We work on closing Guantanamo, ending torture, countering racial profiling of Muslim, Arab, and South Asian folks after 9/11, countering government surveillance, countering drone strikes, and government oversight and accountability. So a large chunk of our work ends up building out media capacity and amplifying narratives on the Islamophobia work that we do. And over the past couple of months, of course, we've been seeing a lot of that Islamophobia being connected to the refugee issues. And so Rethink wanted to provide an op-ed training that gives you some tools to appropriately message, write, and pitch op-eds and letters to the editor in your state for a state-by-state campaign. And I know that there is going to be a tracking document that I believe Catherine or Tim are going to talk about at the end for you guys to plug into for deadlines and commitments for the state-by-state campaign. So with that, we're just going to get started. The first thing we're going to talk about is winning your audience. So when it comes to op-eds and letters to the editor, or really, you know, any work that you're doing in the media space, you need to figure out who your audience is first and foremost. So people come at information and new arguments from their perspective and their experiences, not yours. So when writing op-eds, we advise that people start from a place of most agreement or from a place that pulls people in within the first 30 seconds or, in the case of a written op-ed, within the first paragraph. So that requires that you do your research on the target outlets because outlets want content that works for their own readership. So, for example, the New York Times doesn't write the same sort of pieces that Vice News writes or the Daily Beast writes. They're all very different from one another, and their audiences are expecting very different things when they're reading those particular outlets. And when you're writing an op-ed or a letter to the editor, you want to keep in mind some questions, and those are, who will be reading this? Will they understand what you're trying to say? How can you empathize with them? How can you connect with them quickly? And so those are sort of the things to keep in mind as you're writing an op-ed. And on the messaging itself, we like to call it getting inside the circle. So connecting to your audience using shared values or using certain regional, cultural, or demographic variables that you could be mindful of when it comes to that, right? So common values shape dialogue in a big way by creating connection. You want to make it personal. You want to find a space of shared values so that your audience being inside the circle and you being outside the circle, your end goal needs to be to get inside the circle with your audience. And also, if possible, push your opposition out of the circle. So I've got a couple of examples for that in the next few slides, but that's a key thing to make sure that you're keeping in mind when you're writing an op-ed or a letter to the editor, just keeping your audience in mind and understanding that they will come to your piece from their perspective, and so knowing that is going to be important. So this is something that I saw on Facebook, which cracks me up because I have a friend who writes like this, status updates like this fairly often. Friends don't let friends plot to dismantle the imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist, hetero patriarchy alone. So what is that meant to show? I love my friend, and she's often very right, but jargon sometimes not very effective in an op-ed, right? So there's jargon and being right versus being effective and trying to avoid jargon that maybe goes over the heads of your audience, right? So too many times folks will craft an op-ed with 15 different points to show how smart they are, how much they know, simply to reinforce how right their argument is. And that's sometimes not useful with the broader, more general audience. So being effective requires keeping the argument simple and clearly supporting with facts and reasoning that's easy to follow. So a rule that we like to tell folks is if your 12-year-old cousin doesn't understand what you've written, then your piece probably isn't going to run very well. So try to avoid jargon. Also, make it personal. This is actually one of my favorite pieces. It's ran in Slate in 2014. It's called Terrorist or Teenager, and it's written by Noreen Shah, who worked for the ACLU and is now with Amnesty International. And she wrote this piece about the Countering Violent Extremism program that has proven to have some problematic implications in that it seeks to determine factors of radicalization amongst youth and ends up a lot of times targeting Muslim youth. And so in her piece, she writes terrorist or teenager, and she writes about being a teenager and how sometimes she was belligerent, opinionated, defiant. And when she was growing up, that's just the typical, how a teenager often reacts to the world around him or herself. But in today's day and age, if you're a Muslim and you're going sort of through that same teenage angst, that could very well be mistaken for a sign of radicalization. So she made it personal, and it does a really great job of sort of bringing that home in terms of, teenage angst and what it looks like. So this is a piece that we wrote for one of our member organizations after Representative Molly White in Texas had made some disparaging comments about Muslims who were coming to visit the state capitol on Muslims at the Capitol Day. Representative White had said that if any Muslim constituents were to visit her office, they would have to pledge allegiance to the United States and sort of became a darling of the Republican Party's more conservative wing because of it. And so this is a good example of connecting through shared values. So the first paragraph, she says, Texans fall victim to a lot of stereotypes. Some of them I can get behind. We love our football. Everything really is bigger here. Delicious, artery-clogging food is our specialty, and we're the friendliest, most hospitable bunch you'll ever come across, with big hearts to match the bigness of the rest of the state. Unless you're Texas State Representative Molly White, who made headlines this week, and she goes onwards. This is a great example of connecting with an audience through shared values. This is a Muslim American woman who lives in Austin, Texas, who starts from a space of, we are Texans, this is what it means to be Texan, and effectively gets inside the circle with her audience. And simultaneously in the second paragraph pushes her opposition outside of the circle, right? Like, this is who we are, this is what it means to be Texan. This is what being Texan is not. So she gets inside the circle through shared values with her audience and is then able to push her opposition outside of the circle. So common values shape dialogue in a really big way, and you want to see how your ideas fit into the big picture and how it fits into the rest of the ecosystem. So we've talked a little bit about connecting with your audience and winning your audience. Now we want to talk about winning the opinion page. So what does the opinion page look like, and why is it important? So winning the opinion page, we've got editorials that come from the paper's editorial board itself. You've got op-eds that come from folks who write into the newspaper with their perspective on stories of the day or of the week. Postscript, you've got letters to the editor that people write. The importance of the opinion page is that it's an influential platform. It's one of the most well-read parts of a newspaper, and people often will share opinion articles that they like with their circle, with their friends and their family, and these are sometimes the most shared pieces in a newspaper or a print or online platform. And people will actually form opinions based on what they've read. The challenges, of course, with this are that your op-ed must be newsworthy, but you can't be breaking a story that isn't already on the newspaper's radar. So it has to be something that they've been following, something that's very fresh, within the last 48 hours at most, and something that the newspaper has already perhaps written about in their news section. So what are the challenges to writing an op-ed? Some of the things that people point out are the time that it takes, the odds of getting your piece placed in an outlet, not really understanding or being able to write according to editorial needs, the construction of an op-ed, and what the rules are for pitching an op-ed. And we've sort of got counter arguments to each of these things. So Time, yes, op-eds do take time. But the good part is once you get really good at it, the more you practice, practice makes perfect. So the more you do it, the more quickly you'll be able to turn an op-ed around. In terms of odds, you can improve the odds of writing an op-ed or of getting an op-ed placed when you know the rules of the game, which we'll go over a little bit further in the presentation. Not understanding editorial needs, so it's helpful to know what an editor wants. You know, what does an editor look for? And we'll talk a little bit about that in the presentation as well. We'll also talk about how to construct an effective op-ed. And then talk about rules for pitching. So everything like from do I send it as an attachment? Do I put it in the body of an email? And sort of just general rules for pitching that increase your chances of getting an op-ed placed. So one of the first questions that's actually the best for sort of guiding how you do the work is what does an op-ed editor want? And this picture is of Juliette Lapidote, who is the op-ed editor at the Los Angeles Times, one of the largest newspapers in the country on the West Coast. So what does an op-ed editor want? And we talked about this a little bit earlier, but it really does depend upon the outlet, right? So the New York Times wants a very different perspective than the Washington Post, for example. A Washington Post will often run very inside the Beltway stories. The New York Times will write sort of loftier pieces. But, you know, basically what op-ed editors are looking for are unique angles. So someone local on the ground with a really interesting story or often someone with a very different perspective, right? So, you know, when it comes to a particular issue, if you're the audience and you are the reader, do you want to read something written by a policy expert, or do you want to read something written by a person affected by that particular policy, right? So often the person affected by the policy becomes a very unique voice, or a person who, you know, you wouldn't expect to write about a certain topic can often provide a very unique angle that's helpful for the outlet. Timely content, very, very key. The op-ed piece should be something that responds to the news, that responds to something that's been happening. And I'm going to go through examples of each of these, but I just want to make sure that we go through these very quickly. Expert voices, you want people who understand the many sides of the issue. Balance, usually. So some outlets are an exception, but most local papers will want a balance of opinions on a particular topic. So they'll often run one piece from one side and one piece from the other just to make sure that they're providing a balanced perspective to their audience. And then you want to make sure that the piece is written with the outlet's audience in mind, right? So, you know, that piece from the Austin American Statesman, it really touches upon Texans and what it means to be Texas, from Texas and this sort of us mentality. On a larger, more national scale, Foreign Policy magazine tends to have a very informed readership. It's a very specific niche, because why would you read Foreign Policy magazine if you weren't interested in foreign policy? So their op-eds tend to be a little more policy-oriented, a little more in the weeds, but it's always good to have a piece written with the audience in mind. So just some examples of what that looks like. What op-ed editors want. I tried to pull pieces that were related to the refugee issue that we've been seeing. But the Los Angeles Times ran an op-ed, "The Story of Christmas Makes It Clear, Welcome the Refugee." So tying a news story to an unexpected angle or particular anniversaries or days of commemoration can be very helpful. The second one, you've got fear of refugees, a flashback to the Holocaust, very different perspective. But if you write something close to Christmas that ties Christmas into the refugee crisis, that'll be a good news hook. Or, you know, if I don't think they did this, but if you're writing the Holocaust piece on Holocaust Remembrance Day, you know, that's a good news hook for the paper that you're trying to pitch to, for them to take this particular perspective on the issue. Unique perspective can be just a unique angle or a unique voice, or, you know, the voice of someone who is affected by the issue, or it could be tied to anniversaries or holidays. as a way of engaging op-ed pages. And I know, just a quick note, you all are probably aware of this, but World Refugee Day is coming up, I think, on June 20th, so that could provide a key hook for placing some of these pieces as well. In terms of timeliness, so we're looking at this from the perspective of a particular news event. So if we're talking about the San Bernardino attack that happened in December, after a major news event, you have about 2 to 3 days to get an op-ed piece placed. Because the way news coverage works is an event happens on one day. So the San Bernardino shooting, the first live coverage that we started getting of that incident was on the 2nd. On the 3rd, you know, a lot of outlets were still trying to make sense of what was happening. And 2 days later is when you really started to get the opinion and analysis of the impact of this on the refugee community. And so Friday, and I would say Saturday, Sunday, and probably a little bit on Monday, you hit more of those news, the opinion and analysis sort of pieces. It's a quick turnaround for someone to draft an op-ed, but it's actually a pretty long time for the news cycle to start commenting on what just happened. So from our perspective, it seems like a very, very short turnaround. But you know, from the perspective of the news outlet, it's actually a pretty long time. And you know, of course, you've got San Bernardino taking up a large chunk of this week and probably a large chunk of next week. So you want to make sure that your news is timely, because let's say that you're an activist who's working on animal rights issues. Would this particular week be a good time to pitch your op-ed on animal rights? Probably not, because most news outlets are going to be focused on this particular major news event, the San Bernardino shooting. And we'll see, actually, there was a piece placed in Mother Jones 2 days later, 2 days after the San Bernardino attacks on December 4th. Yes, one of the California shooters was an immigrant. No, don't blame refugees. Talking about the refugee process in this sort of more progressive outlet. So while that turnaround time seems very quick, it's actually very slow in terms of the news cycle. So that first 48 hours after a particular event or a particular news hook are going to be key. And then we've got expert voices. We have, on the topic of refugees, the New York Times published a piece earlier last week, Refugees Shouldn't Be Bargaining Chips. This was published by a gentleman named Ben Rollins, who is has written a book following the lives of people in refugee camps, and you know, seems like he would be an expert on this issue to us. We've also got, you know, there are expert voices from a policy space, but then there are also authoritative voices, right? So the actor Mandy Patinkin visited a refugee camp. There was a very powerful video that he put together on his experience, you know, seeing these refugees, seeing what goes on in a refugee camp and sort of what folks are experiencing there. And he wrote a great piece that was written originally for the Washington Post, as you can see here, but then also ran, the same piece ran in the Salt Lake Tribune, because often pieces will run in other outlets as well, especially by syndicated columnists. And so it's a unique but similarly authoritative voice to talk about a personal experience with the refugee crisis, and that's sort of the firsthand experience of the refugee crisis. And then another powerful piece was from Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State, who spoke in support of states accepting refugees at a time when, you know, there were governors of other states, and I'm sure you're all aware of this, who were signing pledges stating that they wouldn't take in more refugees. And so his piece was, you know, especially poignant as well. And, you know, that being said, this seems very sort of lofty and daunting, but really, you're all experts in something, right? All of us are experts in some particular part of an issue that we work on. And so really, when you're writing an op-ed, it's a matter of establishing what that is that you're an expert on and figuring out what role you can play in the issues around you. And I think, you know, a lot of these pieces about refugees and compassion and humanity coming from the faith community can be particularly powerful for that reason. You know, you guys are sort of experts on that. So that's your niche. You know, that's where you guys are the experts. So we've got a local angle on a national story, so that also tends to be a unique perspective. So this was an op-ed written in the Boston Globe by Congressman Seth Moulton, who represents Massachusetts' 6th Congressional District. He wrote this piece in the Globe last year, I believe in December, and he provides an interesting, or in November, he provides an interesting sort of perspective on this as well. He is a member of Congress. He is also from the Massachusetts area, so this is particularly unique and does well for the Boston Globe audience. He also sort of hits a bunch of different check boxes here because Representative Moulton is also a veteran himself. So he's a veteran, and he provides a great counterbalance to the frequent question that he got from his constituents, right? So a lot of his constituents would ask him, if you want refugees here so badly, why don't you take in a refugee, which is right what a lot of members of Congress hear, and I'm sure a lot of advocates hear as well. And he actually did. So Congressman Moulton's translator from Iraq stayed with the congressman in his home after entering the country as a refugee. And so, like I said, it's a great example of providing a local angle on a national conversation and also hitting a lot of check boxes, right? So you've got veteran, you've got congressman, you've got someone who's actually housed a refugee talking about this experience in a local paper like the Boston Globe and really hitting the Massachusetts audience with that. So now that we know a little bit about what op-ed editors want, we're going to talk about the more technical aspects of writing and placing an op-ed. So a lot of newspapers will have a sort of an online page on their website that talks about their letter to the editor and op-ed policy. It's fairly easy to find. You can Google search it, but it's really, really helpful to do your homework on the outlet and make sure that you know what their parameters are. Each paper will have different parameters, but they'll specify what those are and how you should submit your work in that part of their website. So this is a good example. You know, they're very specific at Pacifica Tribune. They talk about being brief. So they say, for letters to the editor, 250 to 300 words, and about 750 words for op-ed pieces. And that's usually the ballpark that you want for op-eds. They should be between 600 and 800 words. And again, it's going to be specific to the outlet, but those are usually the average parameters for an op-ed piece. And, you know, often pieces that are too long or require, you know, too much editing or chopping down, those end up taking up a lot of time and maybe not running in a timely way because of the edits going back and forth. So they also ask that folks be civil, no name calling, no rants or sermons. They want folks to be clear and concise. They want to make sure you're checking your grammar and your logic. And they ask that you send the final version only. So it's a good idea to proofread and edit or have someone edit your piece before sending in. And again, you know, we talked about how there's a 48-hour window. So, you know, writing a piece requires writing it, making sure it fits within the parameters, and also getting, you know, someone else to take a look at it and see if they can edit it and get it back to you before you can get it to the outlet itself. And they have a deadline for submissions. So not all outlets will have this, but again, each outlet is its own beast. And they are very helpful in providing a deadline. They say Friday noon of the week preceding publication is when they ask for all submissions for their op-eds. So again, you know, super easy to Google the outlet that you're aiming for and see if they have these parameters. You can also easily reach out to us at Rethink Media, and if you're not able to find that information, we're happy to be a resource in terms of finding that information out for you if it's not readily available online. So if you have an outlet in mind, just reach out to us, and we're happy to reach out to them directly and see if we can find out what their parameters are. And we talked a little bit about structuring an op-ed. So structure of an op-ed typically looks like this. The lead, and it is actually spelled that way, I promise I didn't spell it wrong. It's spelled L-E-D-E. It's the first sentence or a short portion of an article that gives the gist of the story, and it contains the most important points that readers need to know. So the lead basically gives the main piece of news, allowing readers who aren't interested in the details to feel sufficiently informed to be able to move on through the piece. So, you know, I would say you can take the first two or three sentences to find a connection with your audience, you know, sort of what we're told in school, you know, get your audience interested, and then very soon after follow with the news hook or the lead. And then you want, you know, sometimes your lead can also be an anecdote that's connected to the news story. Sometimes it's the actual news story itself, but it's always very short, always very succinct and to the point. You want to follow that with your thesis. And the thesis is your statement of the argument. It includes statistics or news stories. You can link to news stories that support your thesis. You can link to reports or mention reports. You can build in expert quotes. You can build in history, firsthand experience. Again, that goes back to the personal experience. And your thesis is sort of structured in a couple of paragraphs. So first paragraph has evidence, evidence, conclusion. Second paragraph, evidence, evidence, conclusion. Again, you know, and you can follow that format for most of your op-ed piece. And then you can acknowledge counterarguments in a separate paragraph if you want to preempt potential critics. You can have a big picture paragraph, which provides historical content or provides the larger bird's eye view after your you know, however many thesis paragraphs you choose to have. It could be one, two, or three, usually no longer than that if you're including other points as well. And then you want to end with your conclusion, which often circles back to your lead, right? So it ties the piece together in that way. So it's a, you know, it's a fairly easy format to follow. And just a quick note about the if you do decide to do a counter-argument paragraph, don't do this too early, right? So you want to make sure that you've cited your thesis in as full a way as possible before you acknowledge and address the counter-arguments in a paragraph. So we've talked about op-eds. And I'm going to present another option, which is letters to the editor. And as we saw with the parameters from that one news outlet, letters to the editor are often shorter. So they can, you know, they require a little less time to craft and to put together. But you can think of a letter to the editor as very similar to the response portion of a town hall forum, right? So in a town hall, you have a community leader who brings up a certain issue or they state a position, and then they field responses from their constituents, right? So just similar to this, a letter to the editor is a reaction from an average member of the community in response to either a news item or an opinion piece by the outlet that's been published in the outlet itself. So what does this mean? This means that when you write an op-ed, you're making sure it responds to something. You, when you're writing a letter to the editor, you also want to make sure it's relevant to something that the outlet has run previously. So you wouldn't have a town forum on healthcare and have someone bring up dog leashing laws, right? So you always want to respond very clearly to an issue. And just so we're clear on the differences between op-eds and letters to the editor, op-eds are usually between 600 and, I would say, 600 and 800 words, usually, but again, check with the outlet. Letters to the editor are typically less than 200 words, so fairly easy to put together. Op-eds are responding to a news story that's already been broken by the outlet, whereas letters to the editor are responding to a specific article, op-ed, or editorial at the outlet itself. And you submit op-eds by emailing a copy to the op-ed editor, whereas you submit letters to the editor through typically an online forum. So they'll have an online submission forum for you to be able to do that. Your op-ed, because it's longer, is typically a strong argument with 4 to 5 additional points to support the thesis. So again, this goes back to avoiding jargon or avoiding trying to be right as opposed to trying to be persuasive. You want to keep it to a very tight 4 to 5 additional points, not 15. But your letter to the editor is really one strong argument. And for your op-ed, you should be responding 24 to 48 hours after a story, right? That's the parameter we talked about earlier in terms of timeliness. But with your letter to the editor, you want to respond as soon as possible. So very, very soon after an op-ed or an editorial or a news piece in an outlet itself. So now that we've talked a little bit about content and the technical aspects of both op-eds and letters to the editor, I want to touch very briefly on something that Rethink Media did recently. We had our first round of message testing. And so what Rethink did is we provided talking points that our community has been using to a survey group of about 3,000 respondents online. And we presented them with talking points on 3 issue areas. So they were Islamophobia and countering anti-Muslim bigotry, refugee issues, and then the countering violent extremism program, which I talked about a little bit earlier. And you can see our research design here. We tested several talking points that the community has already been using, testing 22 messages in total, all with A, B versions and 1 C version. So we ended up testing 45 messages in all. Each message was rated on a 1 to 9 scale, with 1 being complete agreement and 9 being complete disagreement. So we just basically wanted to see if our messages are working, if there are any messages that particularly seem like they're not working. This first round is very preliminary and has actually been a starting off point for the second round of message testing we're doing, which has already begun and will probably be completed by the end of the summer, either end of July or beginning of August. And that message testing is actually going to pit messages head-to-head instead of having folks rate them on a 1 to 9 scale, so that each message is pitted against each other message in order for us to see which one ends up being more persuasive comparatively speaking. But I did want to just give you guys to sort of guide your messaging of your op-eds and your letters to the editor, what we learned from this first round of message testing. So we're going to start with which of our refugee messages actually worked best. And just a quick note, out of the 3 issue areas that we tested, refugee messages, generally speaking, did slightly worse on the whole than messages related to American Muslims, generally speaking. Yeah, it's not very fun. But we are testing further and doing a deeper dive. But the messages still performed quite well overall. We didn't hit, I think, less than 60% of respondents agreeing with these. And a lot of folks gave neutral ratings as well. So the best messages were the top message for refugee messaging: many of us are Americans because our parents, grandparents, or great-grandparents were refugees seeking to escape poverty and violence, and the United States opened its doors. We should carry on this proud history. So we had 63% agreement with that, 27% were neutral, which is a fairly large chunk, and only 11% disagreed. And I should also note, as we're talking about the message testing, is Rethink has a policy of testing messages in a very neutral way, and we understand that not all of these messages can be used or adapted by every organization. Some of them could be problematic for the work that you're trying to do, but we present the testing that we've done as a take what you'd like and leave the rest. So some of these messages may be useful for your organization. You may be able to adapt them or at least use the themes in starting off an op-ed, right, to get your audience to a place where you can then talk more about your particular stance on the issue. But we just want to present you with the information so you have it. The second best performing message, public prejudice towards Jews was very high in the 1930s and 40s, As a result, the U.S. rejected thousands of Jews trying to escape Nazi Europe and closed our borders to refugees. Today, we know this policy resulted, however indirectly, in the deaths of thousands of people who might have been saved. So that message had 59% overall agreement. 34% were neutral, so again, a large chunk are undecided or neutral about this particular message, and only 7% disagreed. Our next message, proposing that refugees should be barred from entering the United States on the basis of their faith is unconstitutional and un-American. It goes against the very core of our First Amendment right to freedom of religion. So that also had relatively high levels of agreement, with 63% agreement, again, 27% neutral, 11% disagreeing. And the last message, proposing that refugees should be barred from entering the United States on the basis of their faith is the very definition of bigotry. And that had 59% overall agreement, 26% were neutral, and 14% disagreed with that message. And then just a quick, which of our messages on refugee issues worked the worst? First one, the debate about Syrian refugees is really about something deeper, the acceptance of Muslims in the United States and their equal rights to pursue the American dream. So that only had 42% agreement, but a large chunk of neutral at 35% and disagreement at 24%. The U.S. security screening processes that all refugees go through are among the most stringent and exhaustive in existence. Welcoming refugees doesn't have to come at the expense of our security. 47% agreed with that, 31% were neutral, and 22% disagreed. And it's important to note that the alternate version of this message did somewhat better and talked a little more in detail about what the screening process looks like. So again, that's not may not be particularly helpful for some of the refugee organizations, but the more specific we are about the particular security measures that refugees go through in order to enter the country, the better the messages tend to do with folks who are reading them. Refugees fleeing Syria are fleeing war and violence. According to ISIS, these refugees are traitors to the radical Islamic cause. The refugees are on the same side of the fight as we are, and we should welcome them to safety on our shores. So this is basically the premise that's often presented, that refugees are between a rock and a hard place. 49% agreed with that, 31% were neutral, and 20% disagreed. And we posited some theories about why some messages did better than others. We're doing a deeper dive, of course, in our second round, but one of the things that we thought of with this is that often people will read things and there are buzzwords that come with very preconceived notions that will tilt the way a person thinks about a message, right? So one of the things we found in our more generic Islamophobia messaging is that words like diversity, inclusivity, tolerance, and understanding don't work well with the general public because those are words, ironically, that the right associates with the left. So those seem like very uniting words that sort of bring everyone together, but because they're very divisive in the sort of preconceived notions that they come with, right, where it divides people on the right from people on the left because the right associates those as very left-leaning words, that message ends up being less effective. And we posited that something similar is going on with this message because we've got ISIS, traitors, radical Islamic, fleeing war and violence, those are very negative words with very negative sort of connotations. And, you know, some of these actually elicit a lot of fear in people. And so that may be one reason why this message didn't do as well. Again, we're doing a deeper dive to figure out what exactly it was about this message that didn't do well. But that's one of the theories that we had. And then the last message, Americans should demonstrate our moral courage and provide refuge to political and religious refugees from Syria and the Middle East who are fleeing to escape violence and death. This message had 50% agreement, 30% were neutral, and 20% disagreed. So what did we learn from these messages? We have this idea that language matters. And what we've found that in terms of themes that have worked overall is what we wanted to present here to see if they could be helpful towards guiding your op-ed process. So do say and don't say in your op-ed. You want to let the values speak for themselves. While diversity, inclusivity, and tolerance are buzzwords that don't work as well, citing the Constitution or reminding people of, their civic duty talking about amendments does work well. You don't want to connect the refugee debate to Islam, terrorism, or national security if unprompted, because as we saw with some of those last messages, that elicits a very negative response. You do want to talk about standing with people of all faiths and origins against hate. So one of the things that we saw in our more general Islamophobia message testing is talking about faith generally works well with your audience. And interestingly, the word faith is better than the word religion, because when you're talking about faith, you're talking about sort of a more amorphous concept that a lot of people share, whereas religion folks tend to think of it as a very structured construct. And so talking about faith generally works better. Again, you don't want to invoke diversity, inclusivity, tolerance, or understanding, because those are words that the right associates with the left. You do want to refer to refugee parents and grandparents if there's a story there. It's a good anecdote to start a piece off with. But you don't want to refer generally to historical legacy. That tends to do less well. We saw that with our Islamophobia messaging as well. When we talked about George Wallace or Senator Joseph McCarthy, those messages did not do as well for a number of reasons. And those were either people don't remember what that historical legacy looks like, or aren't aware of who those people were, or they do know who they are and they have very preconceived ideas of how they feel about that particular person. So referring to historical legacy often does not work as well. You do, if possible, want to be specific about the stringent refugee security measures that are in place, but you don't want to assure the public generally that the U.S. refugee screening process is stringent. So if you can provide particular examples of how strict that process is, that's useful. But talking, about how you're comfortable and can guarantee that it is stringent does not work as well. Also, you want to call out politicians generally speaking for using fear and hate for political gain. So specificity does not work here. If you talk about politicians generally as a group, or you talk about the media generally as a group, that works well. But when you refer to particular historical politicians or particular contemporary politicians who use fear and hate for gain, that works less well because, again, people have their preconceived notions. We may be fans of President Obama, but the person reading your piece may not be for different reasons. And so naming politicians generally as a group tends to work better than naming more specific ones. And that's all I've got. Either Catherine or Tim, do you guys want to talk about the tracking documents a little bit? I don't know if you guys are on, or Megan, if you want to take over.
Sure. This is Megan Cagle with Church World Service. And Zainab, thank you so much for this wonderful presentation. We so appreciate you sharing so much information with us and walking us through some of the do's and don'ts for op-eds and letters to the editor. Just a quick note to finish up before we move to questions. All of the information today is not only helpful, I know there have been some questions about how this can be applied in a broader sense, and the good news is that a lot of this guidance can also be used in terms of general media outreach and also with social media. No matter what you do and no matter what kind of media outreach you do, whether it's in a press release, in an op-ed, or even just on social media, you want to always keep to your message and keep to the key values. And that's what you want people to take away from whatever you send. And a lot of the information presented today really helps drive home this this key piece of information. And we just really want to make sure that no matter what you do, you can really just focus in on those key values and make sure that whatever you are presenting, people can pick them out and take them away and remember them. We also want to just emphasize that the lead that you use in your op-ed can be used in a lot of different ways as well. That's usually built around your key message and your key values, and you can use that really regardless of what kind of outreach you do. If you're doing social media, perhaps there's a way you can emphasize that key value or issue by using a really strong and powerful visual image, either through a video or through a photograph or an infograph. Those are really helpful ways to visualize the issues that you're discussing. And even in your media outreach, making sure that you really emphasize the key issues that you're wanting reporters to focus in on and relating them to other current events. Like Zainab said, they're wanting to make sure that the events that they're covering are related to other national and local events that people are really talking about. And I think there's so much passion in our communities that we can really utilize all of this information to make sure that we continue to lift up and even grow the amount of coverage of what our communities are doing to welcome and stand with refugees and immigrants around the country and around the world. So, Zainab, thank you so much for sharing all of this wonderful information with us and for everyone who joined us. I know Tim or Catherine with Shoulder to Shoulder have just a quick couple of points that they want to make before we open it up for questions. And Tim or Catherine, just as a reminder, if you're still on, if you can please press *6 to unmute yourself, that would be great. Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Tim Braun from Shoulder to Shoulder. I'd like to echo Megan's thanks to Rethink Media and the IIC and Church World Service itself for helping to put this together. We are, at Shoulder to Shoulder, helping to conduct a state-by-state, more targeted campaign for these op-eds and letters to the editor. And we have a sign-up form for that purpose. We're going to help organize folks who live in particular areas to write these things and submit them at times that make sense. So if you are a member of the clergy or a faith leader or someone who wants to help out, I am pasting a link to our form into the chat window. And if you can't see that or see it right now, you can find that form at tinyurl.com/clergyoped, all lowercase, all one word. And you can sign up there, tell us a little bit about yourself, any particular focus areas that you have, and we can put you into our normal rotation and maybe chat in the future about helping put these good writings out to wider audiences. So feel free to do that and reach out to us if you have other questions about that process. But again, my thanks to everyone who attended and who presented here today for this very important topic. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Tim. We are now about 10 minutes away from finishing up, but we would love to take some questions. If any of you have any questions, please feel free to paste them in the chat function in the online portion of the presentation. I know, just to start us off, and Zainab, perhaps you can answer this, there have been some questions about how we can reference some of the information that you discussed today, and just to reference it going back, I know there were a lot of great points made. Is there an online resource that people can use?
Sure. So in terms of just the information, we have, and I can send this to Megan to pass on to the list, we have two tip sheets. One is on writing effective op-eds, and one is on writing effective letters to the editor. So those are useful resources that we can provide. And we also have a two-pager that sort of summarizes our findings from our message testing. And it talks a little more generically about the themes we came across in all three areas of our message testing, because we tested specific messages, but the lessons that we learned ended up being more broad themes, you know, like referring to faith generally, where specificity works and where it doesn't work, you know, where citing politicians or talking about collective responsibility works better than talking about individual responsibility and that sort of thing. So I'm happy to pass along those resources for the listserv as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Seeing that there's not any questions coming through online, if you do have any questions and you're on the line with us, please feel free to press *6 and we'll take questions. That will unmute you, and feel free to direct your question to any of the speakers.
This is Sister JT in San Antonio, Texas, and the last speaker mentioned things, but how will we get them?
Perfect. Thank you so much for the question. In terms of the resources that were mentioned for best practices for op-eds and letters to the editor, if you RSVP'd for this presentation, I will send out a thank you and also a link to all of the resources that were mentioned in an audio recording of this presentation. In terms of the clergy op-ed sign-up form, if you would like to get in touch with Tim or Catherine at Shoulder to Shoulder, I'm happy to also include that link. It's also currently in the chat function, but I'm also happy and will include it to in the follow-up email that I will send following this presentation. But as a reminder, it is tinyurl.com/clergyoped. And if you have not RSVP'd to this particular webinar, please feel free to send me an email, and I'm happy to send it to you. I'll type my email in the chat box, but for those who are just following along on the phone, please feel free to email me at mcagle@cwsglobal.org.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions on the line? Great. It looks like we have one question in the chat. And it's also asking about the flow of Central American refugees and how that can relate to some U.S. policies. Are there any messaging points around that? Zainab, is that something you can speak to?
It's actually, so possibly the more general themes that we talked about could be applicable to that. So talking about parents and grandparents, you know, referring to the values of the Constitution and reminding people about the legacy. We are funded just to work on those five issue areas, and so the reason why we jumped into the refugee areas was because of the connection to anti-Muslim bigotry and sort of what folks from Syria are facing more specifically. So unfortunately, we only tested messages around sort of that function or that part of the refugee process. I would assume it's slightly different for folks from Central and South America. Again, maybe some of the themes from the messaging, generally speaking, could be useful. But in terms of more specifics, I unfortunately don't have that.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. I think you're absolutely right, and the themes could definitely be carried over and certainly used with some of our organizational messaging that we all have that's unique to our specific area of focus. And thank you so much for the question. Do we have any other questions either on the line or in the chat box? All right. Seeing and hearing none, I just want to thank again everyone who joined us today on the call, and thank a special thank you to all of our speakers and presenters. We so appreciate you taking time to walk us through some of these best practices. It's been wonderful to hear all of this, and we look forward to hearing from all of you who joined us as we continue to show what all we are doing in our communities. And if you do put forth an op-ed and it's published, please let us know. We would love to highlight it and certainly keep track of all of the amazing work that you all are doing. Thank you again for joining us this afternoon and evening, and we hope you have a wonderful rest of the day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.